Hello everyone. Welcome to the Mobility at Microsoft Subject Matter Expert, or SME, Roundtable. I'm Sherry Bettine and I'll be your host. We are the IT Showcase team and we share our stories with you, our customers, on how Microsoft does IT. This SME Roundtable is an extension of our Mobility at Microsoft course, and the folks sitting here with me are some of our IT experts that teach that course. This SME Roundtable today is your opportunity to ask direct questions of our SMEs. These SMEs are a talented group of architects and engineers that step away from their day jobs to share firsthand on how we think about mobility and run mobility here at Microsoft. We've collected up some of your questions in advance, but also feel free to start submitting questions live through the Skype Q&A window. I'll ask your questions anonymously. We'll do our best to get through all of the questions in this hour. However, if we don't, we'll stay behind in the studio after the live broadcast and continue to answer questions on film. This video and the extended footage will be posted at Microsoft.com/ITShowcase. Let's first take a moment to let each of our experts introduce themselves. We'll start with you, Jonathan.
Yes, hi. My name's Jonathan Lewis. I'm a senior service manager in the communication collaboration team within Microsoft IT. So my team manages Exchange, Skype for Business, and SharePoint Online.
Thank you, Jonathan. Arun?
My name is Arun Maningal. I am a software engineer. My team is responsible for building large-scale distributed services and mobile experiences that power Microsoft's critical services.
Okay, thank you. Charlie.
Hello, I'm an engineering program manager at Microsoft in charge of the MS approval application. Our team manages an application that's goal is to be one place to approve all your business processes here at Microsoft.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. Jeff.
Yes, hi, I'm Jeff Brock. I'm a senior service engineer in the information security and risk management division on the identity and access management team, and I manage the Active Directory Federation services and cloud identity for Microsoft IT.
Thanks, Jeff. And Jim.
Hi, I'm Jim Adams. I've been at Microsoft 16 years and pretty much all of that time in the collaboration space, email, SharePoint, and messaging.
Okay, thank you all. It's going to be a great hour. Let's get started with one of our previously submitted questions. Please be submitting your questions now. First topic is Office 365 and mobility. How do the two work together? Jim.
Well, with the proliferation of more and more devices and people's expectation of being able to work at work the same way they play at home, the line between going to work and being at work has been blurred. And with more and more devices coming online, more and more expectations of being able to use their tablets, their phones at work as well as at home, has created quite a bit of pressure on enterprise IT organizations to be able to support those platforms. That's the biggest contribution of Office 365 in particular to Microsoft, is that it's been one of the first platforms that we've been able to offer that supports that type of a scenario.
Okay, great. Thank you. How does Microsoft handle deprovisioning of mobile devices when people leave the company? Please discuss performing selective wipes of the devices and deprovisioning of Intune EMS licenses.
I can take that one. I'll take a first stab at it. When people leave the company, we now have this great new tool called Intune. And so we actually, it allows us to do what they call selective wipe, which was just mentioned. What that means is when you leave the company, you actually have the ability to basically just wipe the business information that was on your device. As Jim mentioned, you know, all our users are using the same devices for home and for things like, storing pictures and all this great stuff, and we don't want them to have, you know, to have to lose that if they leave the company. So we actually have the ability to just wipe your business data and you can keep your personal data intact. So I think that's been a big step forward.
Okay. Jeff, how has the cloud changed identity management at Microsoft?
It's been quite significant. As we think about it now, before the cloud and mobility came about, you pretty much had your hard, crunchy, safe interior, and everything happened on the corporate network, and your identity stayed within the corporate network. And then with the cloud and the internet explosion, that line of identity began to blur. And so one of the first challenges that we ran into when working on setting up Azure Active Directory and the O365 online services was getting our users here at Microsoft to segment strictly between using personal identity for personal things and using your business identity for only business things. And the first step that we took with that was to have people decouple their at Microsoft.com identities from personal type services, Microsoft
like
account, or
newspaper,
formerly known as Live ID, et cetera. So what we wanted to encourage them to do, if you were going to set up an account to manage your 401k, do it with a personal, because you're going to take that with you. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to use an identity that's going to be deprovisioned when you leave Microsoft. Hopefully you're going to want your 401k when you're done with your tenure at Microsoft. And then conversely, we don't want people using a personal ID to secure SharePoint Online documents or Microsoft technical specifications, et cetera. And so that was where, as Jim and can allude to, we came up with both the OneDrive for personal, so you use your personal identity and you store your pictures of kids and family, goes into your personal OneDrive, and then there's the SharePoint for Business, the OneDrive, and you put all of your work documents up in there.
We found employees had combined them in the past.
Yes.
Used maybe their corporate credentials to do personal things.
Right. Yes. Quite often they did. Because back before we had the online and the O365 services, a lot of people, there was a product called Mesh, and a lot of people were using Mesh with their personal accounts, and they were even remoting into their desktops on the corporate network, which was just a security nightmare, as you can imagine. The way that we think about this now is your identity has become the new control plane. The identity is what controls things. The firewalls can't operate at that layer of the services that are being consumed in the mobile world, so it's really identity becomes where you control where your information is stored, how you're retrieving it, and how you're securely retrieving it.
But we're not prohibiting using personal information at work and doing work at home. We're just making sure that we're segregating it by identity.
Correct.
So we're stressing that aspect of it.
And the cloud has been a significant catalyst to enabling that experience across mobile devices also in a secure way. With the Azure Active Directory, I'm sure that has had a huge impact in that catalytic change as well.
And employees are incented by what Jonathan said, in that if corporate data is being wiped out when you leave the company, you don't want your personal stuff to get wiped out. You want to take it with you. So knowing that helps encourage our employees, right, to keep their identities separate and personal stuff on their personal accounts and work stuff on their corporate accounts.
Yep.
So have we seen that employees have embraced this, or do we still see some blending?
There's still some blending because it's a policy, but at this point in time, it's still somewhat of a toothless tiger. There's nothing that prevents me from taking Microsoft technical specification and dropping it into my personal OneDrive. The services have evolved, and the SharePoint for Business OneDrive is really working well now. For a while, they were a few steps behind the personal type of OneDrive as far as features and performance. But now it works a lot better, and so what I'm sure most of our viewers know, users will always take the path of least resistance. And so if it's difficult to use something, they won't use it, even if it's policy, unless they have to. And then even then they become creative and figure out how to work around the policy. So I think we're getting a lot better now at at users using the right tool for the right job. Mm-hmm. And of course, from Microsoft's standpoint, we're much more concerned about a Microsoft intellectual property winding up in a personal container store, because after they leave the company, or if the phone gets lost or the device is lost, and they wipe the business section, now you've still got information that might be on an unencrypted or in a personal space that did not get touched. And so there's still, I'm sure, in product backlogs, I'm sure there's things on how we can deal with that. But I think as this progresses, as I mentioned earlier, we had kind of that hard, crunchy exterior back in the days before the internet proliferation and the mobile devices. And now that this is flip-flopped and basically the internet is your corporate network now, I think we're going to see, as the identity becomes a new control plane, we will see this ratcheting in even tighter, and that data will have its own protections around it. That's really, I would say, the long-term end goal, is that you can have atomic control of data, and then control by setting flags or using, say, like
auditing,
RMS type of things, so auditing, yeah, and knowing where it goes, and even preventing it. So if this is an RMS protected document, it has the right flags, and when I try to drag it into my personal OneDrive, it says, no, this is not acceptable. This can only go into these types of storage mechanisms, and it would know whether I'm on, say, on-premise or going to my SharePoint for Business.
So for Microsoft IT, we're relying on education, culture shift, and just making people aware that they need to do the right thing. And also, from a technical standpoint, working with the product group and working with our application engineers to make it easy to do the right thing.
That's the key.
That's the key.
Yeah. It's the behavioral changes that you also want to bring about that has a profound impact, rather than just policy driven, like Jeff mentioned.
Yeah.
Make it easy as well as
easy.
Secure.
And we often take the tact of trust and then verify. So we give our employees a lot of latitude, but then we kind of verify it through some auditing that says, wait a minute, you put this there, and that doesn't look right.
Right,
exactly.
So. And Jeff hit upon a good point. Users will always execute the path of least resistance, and if you have draconian measures, they're only draconian because people feel like they have to do it, or they'll take another path. They'll use an outside storage mechanism or something to get past some of those draconian methods. You don't want that.
They still have a job to do.
They still, at the end of the day, they have to do something, and if they can do it easier doing this, they'll do that.
But we are getting better and better tools. So we have data loss prevention. Data loss prevention sweeps the environment. It goes out and looks for cadences. It might be a credit card, might be a social security number, and it flags those sites as having PII data, personally identifiable information. And we require, if they have that on there, on a OneDrive or even a SharePoint online site, we require that they use rights management protection. If they don't, we don't force it on them, but we actually will, send them a notification that basically says, you're out of compliance, you need to click on this link to get back into compliance, and then it'll give them information.
Good.
The manager gets
visibility.
It as well. And we have kind of a three strikes you're out. So if it's a SharePoint site, the first notification will basically put their site into read-only mode, and if people don't take corrective action, then we'll a couple weeks later, we'll actually lock down the site. And what we're looking for is whether that site's actually still being used. So if it's being used, I would assume people are going to call help desk and say, hey, my site's locked. And then eventually, if they don't take any action, then we actually archive it and delete it.
Okay, that's the verify part.
Yes.
Great. Charlie, can you tell us how we identify what to pursue in regards to the mobile experience for an enterprise app scenario?
Well, basically, the whole point is, as application owners here at Microsoft, or as me as an application owner here at Microsoft, we tend to think a lot about applications. And when you're talking about mobile space, it's actually really hard to move an entire big web complex web application that people interact with in the browsers to the web, or to the mobile web, or to mobile devices, because of smaller screens, less functionality, less power. So basically, the way we think about it is, we look at our application and we see what are the scenarios that people are trying to achieve with our application that are small, simple, and would be good fits for things that are on the go, quick and fast, take a glance, take an action, and then go to sleep, or whatever you need to do on the go. And we move those. So instead of taking the entire application and say, how do we fit this entire thing onto a phone? We sit down and we try to say, hey, we see that people are doing these top three things most often. We're going to move those three things to the phone. And then we're going to, it makes it cost a lot easier. It makes it a lot easier to manage, a lot less complex.
Simpler for the user?
Absolutely.
So they can do it without training.
Yeah.
And user documentation.
Correct. And you know, it's something, like I said, you have to be able to do it really quickly, on the go, within a few minutes. Take a glance, take an action, and go. Rather than, you know, have them open this, try to consume that, or whatever. And as you put more complexity into this type of, you know, as you try to do more complexity, it's harder to move. It makes things slower, makes things hard to maintain. So in the end, you know, by making it smaller and more compact, and really, you know, you could say that your application is, let's say, the full-featured thing on the web, but on the phone, it's kind of a light, you know, a light sort of experience.
So it's not meant to replace everything, but maybe what's most heavily used.
Correct. Maybe it's an augmentation, adding that feature to a mobile app, but not removing it from the web app,
right?
Because you need that full functionality in that enterprise app that you have, you know, in your office. But if you're mobile, you want to have a subset of that functionality on an app.
And adding to Charlie's point, right, about how do you really identify that? We don't just rely upon hearsay and personals thrashing out, hey, I like this feature, so this feature should be incorporated into the app. It's tools that we really use to have data-driven decisions. Tools like App Insights come in very handy, wherein we can actually detect the usage patterns. We can hypothesize and then determine if it has actually, it is the pattern that we had hypothesized that is actually being used in the ground by people. And that helps us a lot in actually making data-driven decisions, which is very important.
So App Insights let you see into what feature functionality users are using,
what is the usage pattern, and determine concretely in lieu of the traditional means wherein we would just decide based on personal or emotional attachments that, hey, I like that feature, so this should be incorporated. That becomes very critical in actually moving the needle to the features that we really require versus the ones that we really thought would be great but then probably fly off the shelves. Yeah,
because engineers are known for creating lots of cool features that nobody ever uses.
Yep.
Or
that absolutely, that is
an,
it's an a developer ego, so to speak. Hey, I can go develop this cool feature, but is that being really consumed, especially in a corporate environment? We never know. So that's where having close insights about your application usage patterns, where is it performing? In some cases, even the performance characteristics are available through that, which helps us know the users are not using certain features, not because they do not want to, but because it's less performant. So in that case, you can go back, put performance as an improvement area into your feature set and improve it further. That becomes important.
Charlie, what was the one biggest feature you wanted to get out in your mobile app?
Well, you know, we have a core functionality, which is just to be able for someone to take a glance at what they have waiting for them to approve their items. And then, like I said, the core scenario we had was we want somebody to see what they have waiting for them, look at it really quickly, and then take an action. And so that was the core scenario. There's other things we have, like the ability to view history and whatever, those types of things. But we didn't feel that those were really heavily used items, according to telemetry, exactly what Arun was talking about. And so we just said that that was the main feature. Take a look at what you have pending, and then take an action on it. That's what we brought.
Simple, easy to use, gets the job done.
Yep.
Great.
So are you seeing a shift in application architecture now for the mobile space? And so instead of building big monolithic apps, are people thinking more about building discrete services and then having like service aggregation points, so to say?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a lot of like, you know, the whole point is, you know, about having, building on top of what other people have, and then, you know, thinking about the user experience a lot. It's you know, people like simple user experiences. They like, you know, something that's friendly. And so that's really, and that fits just perfectly well in the mobile space because if it's friendly on the
And the microservices space is really allowing developers to experiment in their silo and have flightings of experiences as
exactly.
Well.
Exactly. I was going to say, a benefit of this process is it shortens the development time from conception to deployment.
That's right.
And because you're flighting, you might actually gain more insights into some critical functionalities which might have been a blind spot earlier. And about
what's flighting, yeah.
So when you really want to test, you are not really sure of if your feature that you have in your mind is going to work. What you do is you demarcate a subset of users, random selection, as they do in clinical trials and pharmaceutical industries. It's sort of the same mode. So what you do is you, to that small subset of features, you push these features and these
new
features.
So you develop it and you push it out to a small group.
Set of features. And you observe what is the usage pattern, are they liking it. You also have a feedback mechanism wherein they can explicitly give feedbacks, or just through telemetry you're able to gain as to how they're using and are they really using it in the manner that you had originally thought. So that then gives you an ability to decide whether you want to give it to the whole larger audience or the 5 person or the 10 person.
Because you want to keep it simple.
Absolutely.
So you don't want to overload it with features. So you want to make sure you get the biggest bang out of every feature.
Absolutely. And so alluding to the point Jim was mentioning, I invested a certain amount of time in developing that feature. But if I don't see further improvements that are possible, or if I don't see much ROI out of it, I can shelve that. And then without affecting any of the existing apps that is in flight and in motion, or any other service that the customer is at this point gaining advantage out of.
So you can get customer sentiment, if
Absolutely.
You will.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because if they're not excited,
let's
not give it to them.
Yeah.
And also, in the new virtual world that we live in, you can actually spin up resources to create an application very, very quickly.
Absolutely.
And if it doesn't work, like, you know, if the flighting isn't successful, you can spin it back down really quickly. Whereas in the past, you had to buy all this big iron and deploy it, and it would run at about 5% capacity half of the time. So the virtual machines really helped save us a lot of money and helped us be a lot more agile.
So it's cost efficient.
Cost efficient as well. And the other point is about, in certain cases, even if you had resources at your disposal, let's say your infrastructure is ending your life cycle, right? Then you have that transition period wherein you're in a limbo and you are waiting for the new set of infrastructure to come in, or the latest or the greatest hardware, so that your services can take advantage of that in many cases. All those infrastructure level complexities are now abstracted, and you're focusing on the business problem. The developer is freed from having to think about, hey, I can develop this cool feature, but will I have resources to run on? Or let's say even in data crunching applications where you require huge compute power at small amounts of time, can I have it on demand and then just shut it off? Those scenarios get lit up very easily with the scenarios that we have.
So you're cloud highlighting that the cloud really is enabling, is the backbone
Absolutely.
And enabling mobility. And without the cloud, we wouldn't be where we are today with mobility.
That is true.
So Arun, so hypothetical situation, you have a brainstorming session, you come up with this idea that you want to flight. Traditionally, how long would it take to ramp up the infrastructure, the hardware and stuff like that, versus today, how long would it take?
Great question. In fact, you'll be surprised to know that the traditional answer, or the traditional situation, the answer would have been at least 3 months from the time of inception, where an idea is incepted, to the time when you have sent out requests for procuring hardware, getting to know whether can I provision your firewall settings and whatnot. Versus today, it's a matter of days, if not hours in some cases. I know it can be startling to some audience when I say 3 months to a matter of days, because really that is what the cloud or the backbone allows you. You can get your compute resources at the scale that you want and at the agility that you can really happen as.
Well, back in the day, even with the waterfall method, the full life cycle, we had 9 month release cycle.
Nine months.
And that was short. I mean, sometimes they went 18 months.
And quite often, the hardware was the long pole in the tent.
Absolutely.
You know, we would have all these resources working away, and you're waiting for the hardware.
And then
that doesn't happen anymore.
And then in 3 years, you have to do it all over again.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
And then the forecasting of the hardware requirements is not really an exact science. It was more of an art than a science. And
yes.
It was a guesstimate at best, right? And so there was no way you could really predict the way the market forces are going to move, and accordingly, how do you really get your features in front of customers? Mm-hmm. Because that's what you're really focused upon, not really interested in what version of OS you're running, what's your app server looking like. Customers really don't care about it. They really care about, are they getting their work done, how productive they are being in that context, or
and
in
today,
that scenario that they're doing.
Yeah. We don't have to worry about any of that.
Absolutely.
That's great. We can worry about more important things like delighting our customers.
Absolutely. And it's not to say that there is no capacity planning at some level. Yes, it is. But we leave it to the public cloud providers like Microsoft Azure. There is a certain machine crunching all the data that they want to forecast their data centers for, which is all shielded from us. And we are just using the pay-as-you-go method to ensure we get the agility in our processes.
Jim, in what way is Microsoft IT dealing with the proliferation of Internet of Things devices?
It's not just the Internet of Things devices, but also the apps that are associated with all of these devices. With the explosion of sensors in phones, in tablets, in
conference rooms,
everywhere you look, there are things that are connected. And because they're connected, they require infrastructure to be able to connect to. And whose responsibility is that within an enterprise environment? It's the enterprise IT departments, right? Well, with the proliferation of all these devices, IT departments, if they aren't prepared, if they aren't looking into the future, they're going to be caught flat-footed. And they're not going to be able to support all of these devices that are out there.
What's the gotcha?
The gotcha is every device requires an address, every device occupies some bandwidth in networking, and most devices create information, otherwise why have a device? And that information has to be stored somewhere. So there's this back room of requirements for every single IoT device, app, whatever. And you have to look forward before you can start managing these things. And traditionally, IT departments who had infrastructure that they needed to support, they were busy handling outages. They were busy patching servers, provisioning servers, expanding data centers to handle the load and things like that. With the advent of the cloud and being able to outsource that type of infrastructure activity, it freed up IT people like myself to look more strategically at things, look far enough into the future to see this freight train coming down the tracks called the IoT. And as such, we were able to anticipate, okay, there's going to be 5 times as many things that we have to manage in 2 more years. We have to prepare for that. We have to put in the infrastructure. We have to put in the access points. We have to beef up the wireless. We have to beef up security. We have to consider all of these things. And that's just in the near future. And then you have to look a little bit farther into the future on things that are just ideas right now. So we have IT people participating in forums, going to trade shows, going to CES, going to all of these future-looking conferences to try and anticipate what we're going to be faced with in 3 years, 5 years, and as we get further on out. Well, 2 years ago, we couldn't have anticipated what we're doing today. So how can we foresee even 2 years into the future? Because it seems to be going up in a logarithmic scale. So you have to sit back and try and anticipate what's coming down the pipe and prepare the IT organization, prepare the infrastructure, and all the pieces to be able to support that.
So have we always been so strategic, or have we been taken by surprise in the past?
Microsoft has been really fortunate in that we were one of the first huge enterprises to embrace the cloud. So we were one of the first organizations to say, okay, we're going to stop running our own email and SharePoint. We're going to go to Office 365. Even though that is Microsoft, it's still Microsoft IT is outsourced to Microsoft. So we did that. And then BYOD came along. Everybody wanted to use their iDevices, their tablets, all these devices that they own personally, they wanted to use on premises. Well, because we were in the cloud, we were able to respond to that, barely. And we're managing that, and we're making it better, making it easier, making it more secure. The next thing that's going to hit us square in the face is IoT. And we're scrambling to make sure that we can manage that. It hasn't hit us quite yet, but it's only a matter of maybe months before we're having to deal with this proliferation of devices.
So I think when we first migrated some of our Office 365 folks to the cloud, we didn't exactly anticipate the network load.
No, we didn't, and we managed to break our internet egress from CorpNet for a very short period of time. Luckily, we had people like Jeff's team that bailed us out in that endeavor.
So we've been taken by surprise.
In a small way, yes. Yes, I'm going to minimize that, yes. Yeah.
But that's what made us start being very strategic.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
You learn from your mistakes.
You learn from your mistakes. That's
on.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, great. Jeff, do I have to use ADFS to use Office 365 and other Microsoft Cloud services?
You don't need that anymore. It used to be a requirement, but the 365 product team and Azure Active Directory, they realized that not a lot of people have ADFS installed, and larger enterprises probably already have something like Ping or Shibboleth or some other federated identity provider. And so they worked really hard, and now you can create a relationship to Azure Active Directory 365 using any third party, within reason, any third party federation provider.
Have we tried this in IT?
No, we haven't. We use ADFS strictly for our federation, both with our external partners and with, but we, in our federations that we've established with third party relationships, yes, we've done Open Athens, Shibboleth, Ping, all through the gamut of federation providers. So the ADFS product is very mature in that sense that the interop story is really good. So of course, we encourage using Active Directory Federation services, but most federation providers will work with the O365 Azure Active Directory.
We're primarily using ADFS 3.0 internally,
correct?
Okay.
Yeah, you definitely, I would highly recommend using ADFS 3.0 for your relation to establish the federation relationship to Azure Active Directory and O365, because there's, you get the multi-factor authentication in ADFS and other security features that will make that trust a lot stronger than using ADFS 2.0.
Okay, great. Arun,
mm-hmm.
How do we ensure overall quality of any service that is developed in a DevOps environment?
Yeah, great point. When we speak about the world changing into a cloud-first, mobile-first world, there has been drastic changes in the way we engineer products as well. The traditional monolithic way used to be there would be a dev organization, there would be a test organization, and there would be an operations or a service organization. What would happen is the developer organization or the engineering team would essentially be responsible for coding features, and they're not yet responsible for the quality of the deliverable at that point. They throw it over the wall to the test team, who resides in a different organization, if you will, right, rolling up to a different chain, having different success criteria as well. There would be a to and fro between the test team and the development team, and after both agree that yes, it meets certain quality bar, they push it over to the operations team. So over this period, what is happening is the product has never really reached the hands of the customer to really know if it is the correct thing that you are developing. Also, there is a huge time lag between the dev and the test process. All stakeholders are not deeply involved in the overall understanding of the product. They are really interested in their siloed component. They just want to make...
Stakeholder is the dev or the test or the...
The stakeholder would be really the product owners or the customers.
Okay.
And the whole gamut of people who want that product to succeed or the feature to succeed, right? Mm-hmm. Are the developers and the test organizations, they might be interested in their siloed, shiny feature. And they are more interested in augmenting that without seeing how the sum of parts would really fit together and be useful. Mm-hmm. With the DevOps paradigm, the shift is really that the engineering org is no longer demarcating a dev and a test org. What they are trying to say is, if you develop something, you are responsible for the quality of that whole feature as a whole, and you are also accountable of the whole product delivery as well, in the sense that you have to be aware of what is going on in the whole customer feature set or the feature set that you're delivering. You just cannot sit in a silo without realizing the performance impacts or any other implications that your changes in your component can have.
Your component has to play nicely
absolutely
with everything else.
Absolutely, which
and
is very critical.
And it's on your shoulders as a developer to do that.
And likewise, the other component developers have an equal stake. So it's no longer an us versus you mentality that gets incentivized. To add to it, now you do have a lot of tools where you automate your automate to ensure that you have your test cases that cover all the critical features, don't break with your changes and whatnot. However, one blind spot that regularly comes up is the overall functionality testing. So what we do as a process now is we do we do dedicate a small amount of time, not relatively the whole test amount that would have happened in a traditional sense, to ensure that the whole functionality functions within the SLA has gone. Because automating all the whole 9 yards may not be feasible in many cases. So we do ensure we have automations for 90% of all the isolated testings. And then for the integration pieces, we do tend to get together and ensure that the overall quality, the sum of parts is maintained at a bar that is acceptable for the customer.
So you're working in an agile methodology?
Yep.
So can you give us a sense of how much that overall testing effort is in relation to your sprint?
So because we are now conscious about the quality when we are developing, what that means is your development time frame now probably is 1.5x what would have been the traditional time.
So you're doing 1.5 times more time in development
absolutely
than you would have in traditional.
Yes, but in the traditional sense, what would have happened is the 1x time would also mean that 1x time for development, 1x time for testing, and then the to and fro would have been humongous, right? Here in this space, what we're doing is we are taking the hit up front, but with that 1.5x time of investments that we're doing, we are able to save time in the overall scheme of things.
Fewer bugs.
Absolutely.
Bug counts lower.
Yep. And really the bugs, the quality of the bugs have also kind of improved. When I say the quality of the bugs, meaning the bugs are the ones that really matter, not just for the purpose of increasing the bug count, so to speak, right? To put the pressure back on the development team to, hey, go back and improve those processes.
Yeah, you said two different organizations in the past, development and testing.
Yep.
Testing's goal was to find as many bugs as possible.
Absolutely.
And development was get it out the door as quickly as possible.
Correct.
So those two things don't equal quality.
Absolutely.
So
exactly. I mean, the conflict of interest between those organizations really did not help the original business stakeholder, so to speak, whose real intent is to get the feature in front of the customer or the corporate user in many cases and reap the benefits. It was more
right.
about an academic exercise that would have taken place. Again,
there's another change too, though.
Yeah.
Now the developer
mm-hmm.
is supporting his own code
yep.
after it hits production.
Absolutely.
And that's different than what we had traditionally.
Actually, yes. And he's conscious of the operational aspects also, because hey, if the code breaks with the tool sets that are available now, everyone are accountable, as I stated earlier, since everyone is accountable now in the new landscape, he becomes conscious about the operational aspects. He inserts more telemetry points, more events and whatnot, so that he's able to self-healing also in many
yeah.
cases, so that he's able to troubleshoot and reduce the mean time to recovery to a very small amount. So
and now he's self-motivated to
yep.
do that.
Absolutely. Yep.
His life is better.
Exactly. So he does not have to have a late night call in case, you know, there is something that is broken in production. And that process change is really accelerated. Adopting this was not easy, though. I mean, there was huge friction initially, obviously, because you're talking about a cultural change that had to be brought about. And the cultural change had to be brought about from top down. Versus,
mm-hmm.
you know, bottom up and.
And we started with one team
yep.
and then a few teams. We didn't
yep.
try to roll
absolutely.
It out to everybody all
absolutely.
At once.
Absolutely, yep. That
yeah.
was the key to the success. You start small on a low risk project, take the learnings and
yeah.
apply that onto a larger project so that you're not really reinventing the wheel. At the same time, you're learning from your past mistakes and.
And your early teams can be champions
absolutely.
For the rest of the organizations
yep.
to help them learn
true. Absolutely.
The new process.
Yep. Exactly. that's been the keystone of our ideas. Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Arun.
Did we find that that sometimes the Agile lowered the quality of the code in the beginning because the developers sometimes felt like, yeah, I can just fix this later rather than, you know, so, there's less of a need to like do it right the first time because you know you can come back to it and patch it quickly?
True. That was precisely the point wherein initially on, so when we were really transforming ourselves, the initial mindset of, hey, I'm responsible for this component, let me finish this component and let me ship it over. And I can find bugs through the telemetry or whatnot. That's where at a later stage we started putting the accountability of the overall product on all the engineers versus just one or two
people. Reverse that.
Exactly. Right. So that way they were incented to ensure that, hey, I can't just ship a substandard product. Yes, we do talk about minimal viable quality, but then the bar of that minimum viable product is not too low. It is still considerably high, and we are constantly ensuring that that bar remains high and higher.
We keep pushing it up.
Absolutely.
We want to improve our quality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
And one historical aspect of the reason why that conflict really existed within the development and the test orgs were because software engineering being a very relatively a newer field, most of the processes were borrowed from the manufacturing industry, where shipping a manufactured product meant that, you know, the testing or the quality aspect could be looked later on, and they wanted to ensure that only if it met the highest quality bar should it be shipped away to the end customers. Versus in software, you do have the ability to tweak in flight, or many components could be tweaked in flight. I'm not saying all the components can be.
We don't have to throw it out.
Exactly. So that's where exactly borrowing the, you know, development, production, and the quality assurance practices of the manufacturing industry in the initial stages of software engineering process has kind of, you know, kept this industry back for some time now.
We started there.
Yeah,
but we've
we had to start.
Because
absolutely.
We could evolve. Yeah. Charlie. Can you tell us what are some of the challenges in regards to enterprise apps on mobile?
Yeah, I think the hardest part is the, you know, at Microsoft we have, we utilize Intune to manage kind of the provisioning of these apps and the deployment of these apps through something we call a company portal. And the hardest part about it is getting people to use it. So there's authentication, there's two-factor authentication to log into these enterprise apps. A lot of the, you know, I've been told from users and from our partner teams that we actually don't see a lot of usage because people don't like doing two-factor. They think that it's too hard. You know, as I think Jim mentioned, you know, people don't like, they try to get around it, they try to do easy way, they try to save time. And the hardest part is, like I said, when you're on the go, you're not really, you know, anything that prevents you from getting that instant gratification of whatever you want to do is going to be an inhibitor of usage.
And the two-factor is because it's a personal device accessing corporate apps. Assets, right?
Correct.
And so that's why we've required
and not on the corporate network.
And not on the corporate network.
Correct. Yeah. And so, you know, that's definitely a barrier. Getting the app itself is not like as simple as going to the app store and then just downloading it. There's an enterprise app store. You have to join your phone to the enterprise. You have to get it, you know, verified. You have to do the two-factor and make sure your phone's all ready to go and tied to that account. You actually, as you said, have to provide some access to Microsoft to be able to wipe some things, and people don't like that either. So, you know, all these things are barriers to usage, actually, right? And so it's not a Snapchat or something like that, or an Instagram. And so, you know, while people love the idea of like being able to do these things on the go, the practical matter is that when it comes down to it, you know, they're like, oh, it's just too much trouble, or they just feel that many users have expressed that it's just too much trouble for them. That the security, the authentication, the getting the app on my phone altogether. All that is just, you know, it's like I have enough things to think about my day. I'll just go to work and go to my PC and do whatever I wanted to do while I'm at work.
So do you have an answer to that? I mean, has your team been working on how to improve adoption?
Our hands are tied. Well, it's a security thing, you know. I mean, it's all about, you know, some of these things are out of our control. We're an enterprise app, so we have to utilize the security policies. I mean, we have to tie into those security platforms that exist at Microsoft, which are tied to policies developed by the security team. Now, in terms of how, you know, we try to improve that experience, you know, it's about making sure that we try to work as best we can to evangelize and let users know that this is a capability that exists.
that maybe it's just a process, you know, creating some video or some easy way of step-by-step of how to do it, how to get the thing on your phone, because it's just a one-time setup, kind of like, you know.
And it's not that bad once you do it.
Right. Once you get it set up and running, you know, it's like I said, it's like a, you know, putting initial effort into something, but, you know, afterwards it's not that bad. Mm-hmm. And that's all. I mean, I think from an application team point of view, that's what all we can do. We can talk to the security team, and I know they've heard the same, feedback that we've heard from just our application. It's across lots of enterprise applications. So we trust that, you know, that team is working hard to make the experience better across, you know.
So if your users want to use your application on a mobile, they can.
They can. They totally can.
But they can choose not to.
They can choose not to. They can, in fact, they don't even have to install the app. We've optimized our website so it's mobile web. So if you go to mobile web and, you know, you don't have to bother with the installation of the app, you do have to do the two-factor, which for sure is going to be the case if you're off CorpNet and you're on a personal device, you know. That's going to be. But actually, our users will say, yeah, they've used this once in a while, especially when they, you know, are on the go and they're like, somebody pinged me and they said they needed something urgent done. And
they're on vacation. They're on the beach.
Exactly. So from day-to-day usage, you know, they're going to be like, I'm just going to go to my computer at work and do it. But, you know, in some of those instances where it's really important or it's time-sensitive or there's some sort of urgent request, they're like, yeah, I like having it on my phone for that scenario.
So what percentage of your users use your mobile app?
Oh, I think it's about 1%.
1%?
Yeah.
How long has the mobile app been out?
It's been out for a long time. And I don't know. It should be higher. But I think it's a combination of, like I said, some people are surprised. They're like, oh, I didn't know that I could access this application on outside of CorpNet, you know?
So the 1%, does it include the people that use your web?
Yes.
On a mobile
well,
phone factor?
Actually, that does not. So that's 1% is our mobile app usage on the Windows Phone platform. And then when we look at the mobile web, we see a little bit higher, maybe another percent or so. But like I said, usually the feedback I've heard from a lot of our users is that they tend to use it in those edge case scenarios where it's like they needed something done urgently. It's not something you got. They're like, it's not my primary way.
If they're at their desk, why not just use the desktop?
Exactly. Right. So, you know, they get more capabilities there. It's faster. You know, more power to process the web page and all that stuff we use, all the integrations we have, those types of things. They just feel that it's within their normal workflow. So when you're using a business application, you're probably at work. You're not, you know, somebody told me, they said, I like having this on my phone, but then again, it's on my phone. Now it's with me everywhere. You know, I like to keep my work separate from my, you know, as much as I can. So it's kind of one of those interesting things where it's like, I liked having it there so I could, you know, do it. But when I actually prefer to do most of my work at work on my desktop when I'm in my office because I'm in that mode. So it's just a matter of use cases. I feel like in our experience, the mobile use case is that it's great for those one-offs or those urgent time-sensitive requests, those vacation when you're on vacation. Or if you're a salesperson and you're on the go, it actually is super helpful too. Although, you know, they have the capability to VPN as well in their laptops and whatnot. But, you know, I would say that, you know, if you're a sales, if you're on traveling a lot, it's actually, that's a nice to have for them. And in fact, I think I remember hearing some feedback about people who like that, especially those who are on the go. But a lot of the other ones who are in the office most of the time, they're like, it's a one-off.
I think that with more and more of the millennials coming into our workplace, that mix is going to change. They're going to want to mix their personal with work.
Yeah. They don't have the separation.
They don't have separation.
And today we have four generations in the workplace, mm-hmm. and we now have 50% of the workplace made up by millennials. So that's only going to be more and
yes.
more.
And it's true. I mean, in fact, a lot of the questions we always get is, when are you going to bring your application cross-platform, you know, to, mm-hmm. to Android or iOS or something like that, where it's like that's their device. And, you know, it's And we sit down and we say, yeah, but, you know, did you know we could use it on mobile web, which is the mobile web is
the answer for it.
It's the answer for you now. It is. Mainly from a management perspective, from a maintenance perspective, it's a lot easier.
And with 1%, you know.
But then again, we tell
you. If you had 50% of your client base using it, that would be a different story.
Totally different. But, you know, it's funny when we say that, it's, you know, we say it's available on there. We use the mobile web. They're like, oh, I didn't know. You know, so it's a part of that, you know, building that. That knowledge evangelization that, hey, you know, it's not just, this is not your standard mobile app like 10 years ago where you had to go onto CorpNet, and you had to use your mobile web browser and it looked like the interface was from 1998 or something like that, you know, so it's not like that. It's it's very modern, and it's very, you know, think about it like in a way that you would think of you know, your banking website, where it is, you know, I can go mobile web, and it's very optimized, and it'll scale. So it's just, I think we're transitioning towards that with the new generation coming in and all that as well. So I think we're getting there. I mean, our app usage has grown. It's grown from nothing to, you know, a little bit. So
great. Yeah.
And the authentication experience is going to get better. Mm-hmm. It is a very tough challenge to balance security and usability. Mm-hmm. And here at Microsoft, we're really blessed in that we have a plethora of remote access options available to our employees. Mm-hmm. And so, as I mentioned earlier, taking the path of least resistance, if you have to go do approvals, you can go to remote desktop mm-hmm. gateway, you can VPN. Most of our users have direct access, mm-hmm. and so now you don't even have to RAS. You just open your laptop, and no matter where you are, you're automatically connected mm-hmm. to the corporate network, and they can just go to the approvals app on CorpNet. And so a lot of that is you know, they'll take the path of least resistance. Mm-hmm. For authentication, that's a very difficult challenge because the user expectation is that they've had all this time where they were on the corporate network and they got single sign-on because you just logged into your PC in the morning and you went from app to app to app, and all your authentication happened under the covers seamlessly without ever prompting you when things were working right. Now, when you're traversing the untrusted network from an untrusted device, you don't really want to, you think, like, do I really want to cache a credential on this untrusted device so that the user can have a seamless login experience? Or am I going to make them, you know, prompt and enter their creds? And because of the multiple identities now, single sign-on becomes very difficult because on your work PC on the corporate enterprise, you logged in with your @microsoft.com identity, and then that was the identity you presented to every app. But now, maybe you're going to MS Approvals and using this account, and then you're going to Facebook, but you're using that account, and then you're going to check your Hotmail, and now you're using this account. And so now this has totally changed the landscape of how can the device automatically pick the right credential for the right application, and then what if you have two Hotmail accounts, and so now it's picked the wrong one, and now you're like, no, I want my other Hotmail. Don't you know what I'm thinking?
And, and I guess this challenge is going to even remain with the modern authentication methods like Windows Hello or whatnot. The problem that the, you know, authentication methods probably are only going to pose more challenges, if not simplify these, and that's
good. This is great but in discussion, but
yeah, there is a tremendous amount of work going into making the internet login experience with Windows 10 a lot better.
So it's only going to get better.
Yes.
And two-factor isn't as scary as it sounds.
Yeah.
No. I have learned by using
especially with virtual smart cards. Yep. So we don't have to have a physical smart card any longer. We can actually have virtual smart cards, which really helps.
But we are now at the time when we need to start wrapping up. So I want to ask our SMEs one last question. So I'd like to go start with Jim and find out what is one nugget of information you would like our customers joining us today to leave with today?
The best is yet to come. With the Internet of Things, with the devices coming out, and just the ideas floating out there in the internet land of things that people are thinking about, the way we do work is going to be totally different in, say, 18 months than today.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jim. Jeff?
Identity is the new control plane, I think. Identity management in the enterprise is now going to be key to managing data, access, and devices. And so even thinking to the point of device identity now, so to the Internet of Things. And so now you've got to think about how you're going to manage these devices that are going to be all over the place and what level of trust you're going to place on them and how are you going to identify them, how are you going to ensure that they're not tampered with and that you're getting accurate data from them. So I think identity is the first and foremost of
the
this.
Foundation. Okay, great. Thank you. Charlie?
Yeah, you know, for us, it's mobility really makes you focus on what scenarios and what the user's trying to achieve. You know, for us, it's really, we took all the stuff we had to do and we have to really hone in on kind of the bare bones fundamentals of what our application does and make sure that that is what gets done really well on mobile. And I think that's what mobility is basically it causes you to think really hard about what the core of your application is, what the fundamentals are, what the foundation is, and really hone those to create a great experience.
Okay, good. Thank you. Arun.
Yeah. So when we talk about the mobile first, cloud first world and the mobility of experience for users, a cloud really becomes a key enabler of these experiences. And contrary to what many people might find in marketing literatures around how the cloud is cheaper, yes, it might be cheaper in the long run, but the key takeaway in that aspect is about the agility that the cloud brings and allowing you to focus on solving business problems as opposed to the infrastructure problems that you were traditionally solving. So if you were to align your business and were to move it to the cloud, assuming agility as your key takeaway, you would be in a better success state rather than just focusing on the cost factor. That would be one of the key takeaways.
I guess we'll save the best for last, huh?
Yes, absolutely.
Probably one of my big takeaways, especially as you start thinking about moving to the cloud, because probably not everybody's in the cloud today, you need to plan ahead. Think about things, I mean, you need to do these things on-prem as well, but it becomes even more critical in the cloud. Think about things like data classification. We have three classifications of data here at Microsoft. High business impact, which is if that gets out, that's absolutely catastrophic to the company if it's breached. Medium business impact, which is still an impact but not catastrophic, and low business impact. So think about governance. Think about what you're going to do to protect your data in the cloud. Think about things like educating your users. We have compulsory training every year here at Microsoft specifically around how to protect your data in the cloud. So think about these things now. Don't wait until you're going to the cloud. Even the application models. In the past, for SharePoint, we had these full trust code applications. They were very complex. They were very heavyweight. They had to run on the SharePoint servers themselves. And now we have the cloud app model. You can actually create applications in Azure, even if you're still on-prem. But you're planning for the future, because the cloud is the future. So you need to really think ahead.
All right. Well, we are out of time now. So I would like to say to our SME, thank you so much for your time and sharing of your knowledge and experiences today. And to our customers, thanks to all of you for joining us today. We've had some great questions and great dialogue. We do have regular IT Showcase courses scheduled on a variety of topics. Please join us and bring your colleagues. You can find this as well as other content, courses, and events at Microsoft.com/IT Showcase. Thank you all, and have a great day.